Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to episode 78 of The High Low, the weekly pop culture and current affairs podcast brought to you by journalists Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
The weather has turned.
It's horrible weather.
Don't you think it's...
turn all the radiators on.
I know. It's 24/7.
Winter.
I know.
I can't keep up with it. It's so warm.
It's making my skin so reptilian.
Yeah, it's ghastly, isn't it? The skin at this time of year.
I know.
Mottled and dry. The Nivea, I've got out the Nivea. You know it's winter when
it's so cold. Why is it too cold?
It is very cold.
No, I'm not even wearing a coat.
That's ridiculous. I know. Why?
Because I'm running home. Look, I've got.
You need to run home in a
sports bra just on your desk.
You need to wear a gilet puffer that runners wear.
I know. I do need one of those actually.
Grotesque.
And maybe one of those little woolly headband. Yeah.
A woolly headband with the high low on it.
Yeah.
Embroidered.
I would love that.
I had a real moment of being so grateful for being a freelancer and working from home today, because I was sitting at my desk writing the high-low notes and I had a pensive stroke of my chin and I realised there were two new hairs there.
What? How? When was the last time you plucked?
Probably a few weeks ago.
Are you joking? I have to do it every day.
And I ran upstairs and I got out my tweezers and I plucked them away and I came downstairs and I thought, if I was in an office, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I might not have had my tweezers on my person.
Mm.
The light in the loo might not have been good. There might have been other people, you know, maybe superiors that made doing that activity awkward.
You could always see, I think, in meetings when I worked in an office, when a woman sort of pensively
runs her finger across her chin.
I just wanted to
it's
be
like... It's a really unifying experience
for
women.
But you
that.
Just see a woman... It's like all the tube I see women do it and it's like, I hate
and they stop
sister.
And then reverse and go back.
I know what you're doing, sister. Do you know what? Actually, this weekend, Farley introduced me to a natty new little gadget that she has called the Touch Flawless.
Oh, you see these advertised on, like, those weird
JML
channels.
Yeah. It wasn't for me, I must say. It wasn't for me.
What does it do?
Because I like to fully extract the hairs.
Yeah, me too.
Because otherwise, I don't like feeling any sort of fuzz at all.
But also, I like to see totally, the root.
I like the root. I like feeling it completely extracted. You'll get your turn in a minute, Charlie, and you can tell us all about your chin hairs. I like completely smooth chin.
Yeah.
But this isn't an extractor, it's just like a slicer.
Absolutely not.
So
for
it
me.
Doesn't but she really swears by it. The only thing
it's basically like shaving.
Yeah, that's what I think,
slicing.
But without the rash. But the only thing that I have found really effective, I think I brought one in for you to try once.
He did, it wasn't for me.
The springy coil one.
Yeah, do you use those?
It reminded me this weekend that I need to buy some more on eBay. Don't use them anymore. But they were so good, and then you roll up the coil.
I just like some tweezers.
Too time consuming. I'm a busy lady. I'm a you know, modern woman on the go.
Modern woman on the go. Title of your next book, that doll. Modern women on the go. So the cabinet's playing musical chairs on speed. We have yet another Brexit secretary. Can anyone keep up? It's all the news is talking about is the various iterations of Brexit and why Theresa May's failing. And I'm so fucking bored.
I'm glad Dominic Raab has gone back to the Clapham Junction station Sainsbury's in his flip-flops to go pick up some steaks for dinner. That's a little callback joke to a past episode.
Yeah, you know if you're a devout fan of the High Low if you get that. Who's reprinting all the business cards? Or do you think they just have... do you think they're all just written in pencil at the moment for the new Brexit secretary?
Disgruntled civil servant.
Also this week it was revealed that if you are unlucky in love, it's all your mother's fault.
I don't know if... That's a new revelation. I think Freud may have come up with that one first, I must say. Where did you find that research? Foxy Bingo?
front cover of the Times.
Right.
Dickhead.
That just screamed to me of one of those weeks on the high low where we're short on news stories, so we default to Foxy Bingo's latest poll.
Speak for yourself, I am never short of news stories. Speaking of, this week David Hockney's Portrait of an Artist, Pool with Two Figures, became the most expensive piece of art ever sold at auction by a living artist, clocking in at over £70.3 million, or $90.3 million, in an auction in New York last week. Barbecued bugs are going on sale at Sainsbury's this week, the major retailer to sell edible insects, and apparently pet owners choose cats that are like themselves. Researchers from the University of Liverpool found that if you are dominant and impulsive, then your cat is likely to be too. My best friend is going to love that. She always says that my completely psychotic cat, who took 8 months to brave the cat flap, is like me.
Indy and I have never really bonded. I have to say, I've tried really hard because I love cats, but she's always just too busy every time I come round, don't you think?
I think that only endorses this study further then, given that I am also very busy. I do things busily.
She is like you. She's so preoccupied. When I see her, she'll like slide past my legs and she's just running from pillar to post. She's got too much to do. She can't even stop for a second just to have a catch up.
I'm working on it, Dolly. She's not, but I am.
I love that Hockney painting. I'm not surprised it fetched that much. I feel like we're having such a rapid, renewed interest in Hockney, particularly amongst our generation. And I wonder why that is. Other than his work being incredibly beautiful, there must be a reason why I keep seeing his kind of colours and the shapes of his work everywhere at the moment, particularly in interior design.
I've got two theories.
Go on.
One, firstly, is his use of colour. Mm. Lots of other young artists and interior designers and decorators are, I think, really inspired by his use of colour. Mm. So that, I would say, is one reason. And the other reason, I think, is there's a big trend towards people in art at the moment.
Yes.
If you think a lot of the art, so certainly true. That me, you and our friends are buying, a lot of the up-and-coming artists like Hester Finch, Alexa Coe, Juliana Byrne, Luke Edward Hall, Christabel McGreevy, they
spaces.
Are all drawing mainly women and naked women. Luke Edward Hall does a lot of men as well. So it's people, it's the personable. So
that's so interesting. You're so right. And I wondered, there must be, these trends don't happen for no reason. There must be
people.
Yeah, anthropological desire that we're looking for faces wherever we go.
I blame
why
it.
That is.
Do you know what? I feel like whenever I have people have conversations like this at the moment, there's one answer that I'm going to give to you. I blame technology.
Oh my God, thank God I thought you were going to say Brexit. And I was going to say, next!
That too. Today the BBC released its BBC 100 Women list of 2018, and I learned about so many amazing women doing great things, including Helen Taylor-Thompson, a 94-year-old former spy and charity worker who was part of Winston Churchill's secret army, sending coded messages to spies during World War II, and then she went on to set up Europe's first AIDS hospital.
Wow!
And Haven Shepherd, a 15-year-old student and swimmer from Vietnam who is a Paralympic hopeful, having survived a suicide bomb set off by her parents.
What a cool list.
It's a really interesting list. I thoroughly recommend a peruse.
I've got some uplifting news about a fellow broadcaster. 73-year-old Deke Duncan has been doing a radio show with just one listener since 1974. He's never had a licence as a station, so has only ever beamed it from the shed in his back garden into the living room through a speaker for his wife to listen to. And he's never had anyone else other than his wife listening to it. And that hasn't stopped him from producing. He does all his own jingles and he calls on friends to cover shifts to ensure the stringent dawn tonight evening schedule.
I love them humouring him when it's just the wife.
I know. And finally, a local BBC radio station found out about him from an interview that he did in the 70s, I think. It was like some archive footage where he was hailed as having like the smallest audience in Britain.
You were going to say he'd done an interview with Vice.
No, that is very Vice, though. And a BBC radio station, a local BBC radio station, has finally given him a one-hour special to do over the Christmas period. And he said for the first time in his life, he's speechless.
Oh my God, I wonder what BBC radio station is it?
It's called Three Counties.
Okay, I'm going to try and tune in.
Is it? I mean, I'm thinking Christmas special guest, I got to say.
I'd love Deke Duncan on.
I think he's a maverick. I think it's so cool.
Make
but
it
you
happen,
know what? I actually think it's like such a wonderful story in a climate where everything that we do and
numbers.
Every skill that we do is about acquisition of numbers and people knowing how good we are. So I think it's like, I've been thinking about this a lot recently with my unbelievably shit guitar playing. I did record a little I sent Pandora a picture of me last night with my guitar saying,
Dolly's favourite procrastination tool is to take to the guitar.
I said night in with my boyfriend, but I've got some clips to send you. But I was thinking about, because I've just started looking for a new guitar teacher, and I was thinking it's like such a rare corner of my life where I want to get better at something. And
not shout about it,
but I literally don't want anyone to hear it. I don't want, it's not for any kind, it's not to make me money, it's not to look cool, it's certainly not to look cool, it's not to gain friends. If anything, I'll probably lose friends the way that I'm going with it, but it's just for the joy of an activity.
I know, it's with the high low actually, sometimes it's quite hard for us to separate what's a hobby and what, because inevitably a lot of the things that I do for enjoyment or relaxation do then fuel another episode. So I sort of commodify that moment, don't I? I think you should get Deke on the show.
I'm gonna track him down. He seems like such a nice man, and I really want to meet his wife as well. I think that's so lovely.
The story is made for you. I'm surprised you haven't bought like the TV rights.
Do you know, oh god, that would be a great TV show. There we go. That's my next project sorted.
What's in ye old mailbag this week, Dolly?
We had, as ever, some wonderful emails. We got a lot of responses to our discussion on Iceland's banned Christmas advert and our brief discussion of palm oil production in last week's episode. Most of the comments were about how it's a very complex issue, and a couple of people raised the point that the Iceland ad oversimplified matters. Many recommended the same article, which makes the case for sustainable palm oil rather than a ban on it, which we will link to in the show notes. This email summed up many of your thoughts very well. Whilst I'm really pleased that deforestation and the links to global supply chains are being brought to public attention, it worries me when there is a knee-jerk response that gets a lot of coverage without equal coverage or consideration of the implications. I think the major win here is that it forces us to think about where our food and other consumer goods come from. The journey from raw commodity to final product is insanely complicated, but anything that increases our understanding of supply chains and sustainability and forces us to rethink our insatiable consumer appetites has to be good thing. We also received some really informative and thought-provoking emails about Anthony Ekindeo-Lennon's story and how that compares to Rachel Dolezal's story. This was from a listener called Ganisa. Panda, do you want to read this one?
I am an African-American expat living in France. I often hear the talk of fluidity of identity, which is so important in this era. Though when it comes to racial identity, I believe fluidity is less so. Having a fluid racial identity is one right that belongs categorically to white people. As a black woman, I never realised I was black until someone made me feel that it was inferior and less beautiful. I never realised I was black until someone made me feel that it was inferior, less beautiful. In Lennon's case, that happened. Neighbours gawked at him, made a spectacle of his existence because of his skin. That was not the case for Dolezal. She tanned herself, wore traditional African hairstyles, presenting herself. There is a privilege that Rachel Dolezal gets that neither I nor other blacks get, the ability to claim heritage that is not ours. If I were to go around saying I were a white woman, people would laugh. I wouldn't get a book deal or a Netflix documentary or a press tour to describe my experience as a white woman. And when Dolezal tires of being a black woman, she gets to be white again. Although she is now more of a pariah, she always said that she was black. Now she's experiencing the black woman's existence of being cast aside and criticised. That doesn't mean it's right, but this is her most authentic experience to date.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I know we've covered Rachel Dolezal before, but I did think that was a really interesting one to read out. And the same from Alana, talking about the differences between Rachel Dolezal and Anthony Ekindeo-Lennon. And she suggests that Lennon has more in common with Sandra Lang than Dolezal. He cannot pass as white, and so he has probably experienced racism like any other mixed race person. He therefore has lived experience as the race he presents at, white parents or no white parents. Thank you so much for those messages, Alana and Ganisa. We always really enjoy hearing from listeners, particularly listeners who can share their own experience and their own viewpoints that weren't ones that we had drawn in the show.
And finally, I got lots of lovely Irish listeners who messaged to let me know that I can buy Tato's in London.
Well, thank God, because there aren't any crisp sandwiches here today, listeners.
I forgot. I'm so sorry, but I found out...
It's not like you've been doing anything, Dolly.
I found out both Charlie and Pandora's favourite flavour, salt and vinegar, and I'm going to go get salt and vinegar Tato's this week and bring you crisp sandwiches next week. Although everyone has told me that I need to assemble them à table. Because if I do it...
they go sog.
They go soggy. And that's the opposite effect you want from a crisp sandwich. Anyway, back to Tato's. Emily says the cheese shop by platforms 15 to 19 in Victoria Station has them. And even included a picture of them on the shelf.
That's amazing.
And Ornia says an Irish shop in Tooting called Mandy's has them. And a lovely listener on Twitter let me know that Sainsbury's on Camden Road stocks them. So I'm going to head there straight after this record and pick up a packet.
Question is, would you have gone to Tooting though, if they didn't? How much do you want to give us a crisp
It's
sandwich?
On the Northern Line, so maybe. I would have made a day of it.
What have you been enjoying this week, doll?
I have been enjoying Eva Wiseman on pornography for GQ.
Yes.
Did you read that?
Yes.
It's so good.
Where she shared the statistic from John Ronson that erectile dysfunction has increased by 1,000% since 2007.
Which is the advent of free porn streaming.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no way that those two things aren't connected. And she talks about... The reason I really like this is I think talking about pornography, which is a massive problem, the state of pornography now and the effect that it has on both men and women and public consciousness and attitude towards sexuality, it is a huge problem. I find it minimising when people say that pornography itself is the issue rather than the gaze that it is made through and the way that it is made. I think that to watch pornography is a very, very natural inclination. And I think the problem isn't pornography. It's the very, very small range that we're shown and the impact that that has on how we think about men and women and sex. So the reason I thought this was such a good article is what she's advocating. It's the Catlin Moran school of thought that it's not that we need to ban pornography, we need to have...
So you can't ban pornography.
No.
So it'd be like a pointless endeavour.
Yeah, no, but also I think it... I don't think watching pornography in of itself is unhealthy. Bad. No. I think it's the Catlin Moran school of thought that we need free range pornography. We need ethical pornography. We need pornography...
Grass-fed porn.
Grass-fed porn. We need porn that's shown... through a female lens. We need female pleasure-driven porn. We need...
Wibbly bits and bushes.
Exactly. We need all different body types, all different types of sex. And this is what this article said. And I'm not going to paraphrase it because Eva Wiseman's a genius and she said it much better than I ever could. So to quote, she says, rather than banning porn, how about having more porn from as many perspectives as possible? More acknowledgement that sexual health does not stop at an STI test. More time spent hacking away at the cultural insistence that women are either virgins or whores. More conversation about sex at a younger age. More stories of sex from a greater variety of viewpoints. More nuance, more women, more acknowledgement that while some people spiral down the internet and crash, many others turn to technology not just for release, but to explore love and desire from an increasingly lonely place. It's too easy to demonise internet porn or detach it from the real world, but doing so pushes those in trouble further away. Perhaps today, with everything laid out in front of us, young people could be educated about the ordinary and odd and sometimes profound truths of sexuality. Then those who choose to could enjoy online porn the way it was intended, as a corner of sex, rather than the whole world, a brief, diverting, unrealistic fantasy. I couldn't agree more. So... I would
really
like
piece.
More inventive narratives than naughty stepmom and rampant cheerleader. Also on sex, Indian Knight on sex education for girls in response to MP Jess Phillips's claim that young women need to be taught about their own orgasms in school.
Yeah.
That was her most recent column and I loved it and couldn't agree with it more. And she talks about, really relating to Eva's piece actually, she talks about how female pleasure is so misunderstood and still so unprioritised, not just in porn, but in dating and, I must say, even the most loving and respectful relationships. It's still such an enigma.
It's never taught in sex education.
No, and the problem is that I think women are so conditioned to believe that it's so unprioritised and it's not the point of sex. The point of sex is ejaculation for a man. That it means that a woman can go, I think, her whole life thinking that the sex that she's having is totally normal, where her body and her desires are just not factored in at all, in a weirdly consensual way. So I think that we really need to, you know, debunk this and unpick this. And she talks about how she thinks that not only do we need... There are kind of two opposing problems that we have with porn, I think, with porn culture, is that because it only shows male desire and male fetish most of the time, it means that women's desire or fetish becomes shameful because it's not given space, because women are so passive in the sex act in pornography. So women carry shame about their sexual desire. But what India Knight also argues is women are also not allowed a space for revulsion. And that women should, because what you're watching in porn, we're just told, is the absolute default of the desire. The way she describes it is like, everyone should want to have anal sex within 2 minutes of meeting the local handyman, whatever. And also, they should be coming like a train after 10 seconds of it. Like, that there's no space for a girl to say, to realise that that's not for her. Like, that there should be space for revulsion as well as for no shame. I just think we've got so far to go in understanding that women have their own gnarly and disgusting and twisted and, you know, transgressive sexual desires, and that equally they might not.
And if you want to see some of them, you could watch Sally Forever.
Do you know what? As we were talking about that, I was
thinking,
like,
about the nose fucking.
Pandora's been introduced to Sally Forever in the last week, and she is delightedly disgusted with it.
That's exactly the word, delightedly disgusted. It's actually really not even for the faint-hearted. It's not one to watch while you eat.
I've also just realised that whenever you and I now talk about sex, it just sounds like Joan and Jericho.
I'm really glad that the Sunday Times published that column. You know, it was in the opening pages
of the magazine.
A national,
yeah.
Serious magazine. And it was a very progressive column. And, she, you know, she didn't hold any punches. I think I'm as impressed to see them running it as I, you know, essentially a paper that is run by men in their 40s, 50s, 60s, as I am glad that she wrote it. I think those are all good things.
And she also said as well, I think that so often when we talk about how we need to re-examine the female experience in sex, we forget that this is for the benefit of men as well. Like this, which is what she touches on, the pressures that are put on men from the pornography that we have available to us now. That's shit for everyone. That's particularly, it's shit for women on the receiving end, but it's an enormous amount of pressure for men as well. And I think, you know, going back to Cat Person, which that great New Yorker short story which was published a year ago, for me, that's what that story was about. It's about men and women being in a tangle of lies to each other. And how can men know and fully understand about pleasure and consent if we're living in this kind of
expected performativity where everyone knows the roles they have to
exactly
play.
Exactly. So it will be freeing for everyone as we debunk this. So I could just read more and more and more about this, and I loved both of those pieces. I've been enjoying Homecoming on Amazon Prime, which is a drama starring Julia Roberts as a caseworker at a facility called Homecoming that helps soldiers transition back into civilian life. I'm only two episodes in, but I just really like it. Do you know what? A lot of my friends who work in TV drama said to me, this is the best drama that they've seen in a really long time.
Better than Informer?
Yeah, sadly.
You haven't seen it?
No, I haven't seen it. But as in, this is the thing that I'm hearing from quite a lot of TV producers, is that this is really, really a cut above the rest. And it is, it does feel very different to any drama I've ever watched. In
it's
that.
Lofty praise. I'm going to check it
I've
out.
I've just realised it sounds like I only ever talk in superlatives. It may not be the best drama made in recent years. It may just be a very good one, and that's fine as well. But I'm just saying that that's why I decided to watch it, because a few people I really trusted told me to watch it. Anyway, it does feel quite different in that I think it's the most cinematic TV series I've ever watched. There we go, another superlative on the house. The music, it's like a cinematic score. Even the credits, everything about it, the way that it's shot, it feels just epic and very compulsive. And Julia Roberts is just so, so good. So two episodes into that and already loving it.
Definitely going to check that out.
It's very you. Although I already regret saying that, because the minute I say something is very you or not very you, you take umbrage with it.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not remotely contrary.
I listened to Lena Dunham on Dax Shepherd's podcast, Armchair Expert, which a few Hilo listeners have told us to listen to, actually. It's the first episode I've listened to. And I actually found it because I was missing Lena Dunham. I feel like I haven't listened to an interview with her for a while. And she's one of those people who I learn so much from just listening to her muse on things. And I know she really divides opinion. I happen to really love Lena Dunham. I think she's been an enormous force for good culturally. And it's a really powerful interview. It's a long interview. She talks about the trauma of her hysterectomy and the choices, and she talks about the trauma of her fairly recent hysterectomy and the journey that led her there very, very reluctantly. And it is so sad when you hear her talk about it.
She wrote a beautiful piece for Vogue.
Yeah, American very Vogue. Powerful.
About 6 months ago, was it? I think you can find it online.
Yeah, and that was only about a year ago that she had that hysterectomy.
And she'd just broken up with her partner as well, so that must have been a pretty overwhelming time.
Yeah, and she also reveals for the first time in this episode and talks about it in depth with Dax Shepherd, and it's poignant that she talks about it with Dax Shepherd because he's also sober, I think, and in recovery. He's definitely in a fellowship, but she talks about how she's 6 months sober from her addiction to benzos, which are a prescribed tranquilizer. And in that kind of reflection, she talks about how she became hooked on them, and she also just reflects really on the last extraordinary 7 years of her life and fame, and how she was nowhere near prepared for it, and how at 25, the way that she phrases it is that if it were to have happened now, then she's a woman who knows how to look after herself, who has really good boundaries, who gets good sleep, who keeps her body and mind in check. But she was like, it's a 25-year-old girl. Of course, she didn't do any of those things. So then you throw her into this position of being the voice for generation and her kind of holding this mantle of representation, and everyone analysing her artistic and life and political choices. And she said, you know, she just couldn't handle it. And I've never heard her speak, I suppose because she's been so in the thick of it and it feels like she's just moved into a new phase of her life. I've never heard her speak with such clarity about the enormous fame and notoriety that was thrust on her at such a young age and all the various controversies and pressures and anxieties went with that.
How does she feel about, like, has she come out the other side of all those controversies, or do they sound like they still weigh very heavily on her?
I think something that she said in this interview, I have to say I'm only actually halfway through because the interview's about 2 hours long, but something she says that really struck a chord with me is she said she is someone who, that you and I are very like this, Pandora, she's someone who has always been very plagued with guilt, and she's always trying to keep everyone happy, and she's always, throughout her life, she was always trying to control the variables of other humans and control...
Oh God, so the kind of controversial fame she's had must have been...
Well, this is what she said, you know, when you're someone who desperately...
Because I hate her. I know she's been tremendously successful, don't get me wrong, it's a success we could only dream of, but I wouldn't want that.
But she said when you're someone who wants to all the time control what people are saying about you and how they think about you... and she said, you know, her whole life she made such a conscious effort, and my God, do I know this feeling of constantly trying to make sure that people only thought good things about her and are saying good things about her. And she said, when you get catapulted to that level of fame,
it makes me feel a bit sick.
You have to accept that not only are there people who know you who probably don't like you, there are a vast, vast number of people who don't know you who are talking shit about you. And can you imagine that anxiety for a person with that disposition, the level of anxiety that it would inflict?
What's it like to listen to? I don't know if I can, or is it like a...
It's
an intense listen.
It's moving. Yeah, it's moving and confronting and intense, and it just makes me feel enormous sympathy for a person who, yes, has definitely made mistakes and some bad choices, but fuck me, haven't we all? I think that she is someone... I think it's amazing. This is what I get from listening to that interview. I think it's amazing that she has come out the other side as seemingly down to earth and okay and together. As she is, because the more I listen to the stuff that she's been through, and what that trajectory is, was like, the more I think I would have just come apart at the seams, basically. So, yeah, it was a great conversation, and I'm just so excited to see all the future things that she's going to create. And I still think we're very, very lucky to have her. I also enjoyed Elizabeth Gilbert on the TED interview with Chris Anderson, who's the head of TED, and a really, really, really penetrating, brilliant interviewer. I think this is the first interview that Elizabeth Gilbert has done since her partner Rhea died.
For anyone not familiar, Elizabeth Gilbert wrote the global bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, where she detailed falling in love with a man she then married. She then left the marriage to begin a relationship with her best friend.
Yeah, her best friend,
Rhea, who has very sadly recently died.
Yeah, and she went into that relationship knowing that Rhea had a terminal illness. And she is quite disarmingly honest about the whole experience, actually, because she's been fairly honest. I think she's a woman who lives with a lot of integrity and very truthfully, even on her social media channels. I think that she's quite admirably open and doesn't feel kind of shame about various choices that she's made in her life. So it's kind of amazing to listen to her talk about. And actually, the interviewer said, did you feel a pressure having written this book that many women feel has like a fairy tale ending and they're very invested in that relationship? Did you feel a pressure or like you were disappointing people when you publicly...
That reminds me of Holly Bourne.
Yes, Herbert. Exactly. How
when
do you like
now? When the fairy tale falls apart, for yeah. want of a better expression.
And she said, no, I don't. And she said, and I had full faith that my readers only wanted happiness for me. And it was such a lovely thing to hear. She said she got absolutely no abuse in response to her new relationship with Rhea. And she said that people were just supportive and happy that she was in love. So that was lovely to hear. She talked very movingly about death and what it's like to see someone you love die, to be with them at the moment of death, and grief she talks about in the most poetic and beautiful and vivid language. I've never heard someone talk about grief in metaphors that were more tangible. It just is a testament to what an incredible, incredible writer and articulator she is of the inner landscape and life of a human. I don't think there's anyone quite like her in terms of making those emotions accessible and understandable to others who aren't going through it or who've been through something similar.
Are you a big fan of Eat, Pray, Love?
Loved it.
Do you think if you're not a massive fan of Eat, Pray, Love, you would still find the podcast interesting?
Yes, because she doesn't actually talk about Eat, Pray, Love that much. She talks about subsequent books.
Just because the book was quite divisive, wasn't it?
Yeah. I know, I just loved it.
I liked it. I did. I found it a little bit indulgent and woo-woo at times.
But that's me. I'm very woo-woo.
You're not woo-woo, but you like woo-woo things.
Well, speaking of woo-woo, the clip that I'm going to insert is one of my favourite bits, is when she's talking about the concept of magic and the belief in something...
That is speaking of woo-woo.
The belief in something higher or unexplained, and I'm very much of that camp. And she says that she doesn't use a belief in magic or supernatural or unexplained or spiritual to contest logic or analysis or intelligence, but that it's a faith and a curiosity that bolsters her understanding of life.
I happen to prefer to live in an enchanted world, but I don't require that anybody else does. If you're empirical, right, left, black, white, everything can be explained by science. Worldview helps you, and you can be as creative as you can possibly be within that, and you're generating an enchanting life through that, then you have what I like to call not a problem, you know. But if it's not working for you, then, you know, come and sit in my room for a minute.
What have you been enjoying, Panda?
I read a proof copy of Mothership by Francesca Segal, who has written two books, including The Awkward Age, which was a very popular book that came out last year, I think. It's a beautiful memoir about her twin girls who were born 10 weeks early, weighing £2 each. I fully immersed myself in this memoir. It obviously brought back memories of my own birth, a day I like revisiting hugely, but it also educated me about a shadowy other world of birth, that of severely prem babies, and of course reminded me of how incredibly lucky I am. Segal's babies are in the neonatal intensive care unit for 50 36 days, so almost 2 months, she had to pump her milk day and night in the pumping room. For a while, her babies were in different hospitals. It's a beautiful, poetic book about a different kind of motherhood, or at least a different start to motherhood, that you don't hear as much about, where mothers, in her own words, are prevented from mothering.
Yeah.
They can't take their babies home. They have to feed them through an incubator. They're allowed to hug them once a day. They're very much told by nurses when they are and aren't allowed to mother, and yet their bodies are in, or her body was in, full mothering mode. I just wanted to read an extract from the book of a bit I really loved, so you can get a taster. And she's at home a few days after giving birth, but her babies are still in hospital. I'm fascinated and appalled by the remaining slack pouch of flesh where 100 hours ago I housed our daughters. In the dark, I touch it gingerly. This is where they should be, beneath the covers, beneath my skin, palpable and distant, drawing slowly closer to us like a ship from the horizon. Where now do they believe themselves to be? I have visited the mothers of newborns. I have seen their fatigue, their distraction, their longing for just a breath of liberty from this new consuming tyranny. But I remember too that when a helpful friend takes the child from their arms, that stunned and softened look will sharpen, replaced by one of hunger and an urge to snatch back the baby they have only moments ago offered with relief. I have seen their jealousy, a fleeting separation, seductive and intolerable. When I am apart from my daughters, my physical pain becomes almost incapacitating. I wonder which is real. It's fading to a meaningless background hum in their presence, or now, like this, it's raging grip in their absence. Such a wonderful
book. I haven't thought of it like that, but about that kind of primal instinct. Do you feel that when I grab Zadie?
No, now I've obviously got very used to not holding her at all times because I'm working 4 days a week. But I know exactly what she means. At the beginning, it's so all-consuming and exhausted. But the moment you're not holding your baby, you miss them desperately.
Yeah.
And actually, when Zadie goes to bed, I said to Ollie the other day, I wish instead of her having to sleep for 12 hours at night, I could choose to sprinkle those hours throughout the day, because as soon as she's gone, I probably creep back in every hour that I'm still awake to, you know, adjust something or just sniff her, and Ollie always goes, did you wake her up? So it's a beautiful book, and I know I always say this, I sort of shouldn't have to say this disclaimer, but I don't think that you have to have just had a baby to really love it. I think it was particularly piquant or poignant for me because I had, but it's just like an exceptionally well-written memoir. The book's published by Penguin in June 2019. Sorry, I know it's a real wait, but I have to tell you about things as I read them or it will fall out the other side of my head.
Also, while we're on this subject, I don't know if I told you this, I got an email recently from a man who wanted to...
Not a man, Dolly!
Sorry, I said that with a weariness.
Withering disdain.
Saying that he finds it smug and irritating whenever I talk on the high-low or on social media about the fact that I've got a proof of a book that's not out for a few months, and it's like I'm showing off to everyone. For anyone who holds that opinion, which I'm hoping is very few of you, as someone who's published the book, I know it is a bit frustrating when you have to wait a few months before a book's come out, but by no means are Pandora and I being smug. We're helping with a campaign of a book we really believe and building excitement around it. So that's a massive part of making sure that books are sold. So that's all I would
like
to say.
It's also kind of unavoidable because we're sent brilliant books as proofs. They go onto the pile by our book. We pick them up because we love an author. I'm not going to not mention them until the month they go out, because A, I'm not that organised, and B, Amazon, Hive, Waterstones, Penguin, you can pre-order through all of those things.
As I say, I think it's a very, very slight held opinion. I really hope it is, because I was quite upset.
I don't give a shit
by that email, but I just wanted to flag that because it is a really important part of building momentum for a book's pre-publication, and Pandora and I are really passionate about publishing, so we're very happy to be a part of that process.
And I remember how excited I got when people were pre-ordering your book. It's an important part of purchasing. Well, a book that is out now is Popular by Mitch Prinstein. I think it came out last year. I read it for an essay that I just finished writing, and I found it such an interesting book, I wanted to recommend it here. Prinstein is a neuroscientist and psychologist in America, and he offered a new take on likability, which I think is always seen as something negative. It's the idea that if you are preoccupied with being likable, that you're bending yourself into a false you.
There's a lack of integrity,
in order to make people like you more. And he says that actually likable people tend to be popular because they reflect values which are important to others. Likeability, he says, leads to inclusivity because you tend to work to make people feel part of a herd, which makes them feel valued, and it makes you as the byproduct popular. He said the only time that likability is a bad thing is when it is used for status. Mm. So in our Warholian world, everyone's bidding for status. And that, he says, is an empty, flimsy aspiration of popularity and of likability. It's a really interesting book, and I recommend it. It covers our lifelong desire to belong to a clique, from playground to parenthood, why popularity is so seductive, and why leaders aren't always boorish bullies. For example, Obama, very likable, very good leader.
Yeah.
So I like that. A new take. I absolutely adored the episode of Elizabeth Day's podcast, How to Fail, with Tara Westover. Tara wrote the hugely successful book, Educated, which I recommended in our Back to School episode of the Hilo in September. I read it during the summer, and it's a book about Tara becoming estranged from her fundamentalist Mormon family in order to seek an education, first at Brigham Young University in Utah and then latterly Cambridge. Tara has such a unique perspective on things. Even the way she talks is so unusual, and I know Elizabeth felt the same. She's measured, she's very thoughtful. The way she speaks is entirely unusual. She doesn't hesitate or ask rhetorical questions or use intensifiers. She doesn't revise herself or self-edit or prevaricate. I wanted to play an excerpt because she's such a unique mind, and Elizabeth, just like the listener, is, you can tell, entirely fascinated with her, and I was too.
I felt like I belonged in my family. I always felt like I belonged in my family. I've been raised by them. I agreed with them about everything. I had full membership in that. It's probably the only group I've ever felt like I fully belonged to. The reason I left wasn't because I didn't feel like I belonged. It was because there was something I wanted on the outside.
I read a super interesting piece on The Atlantic, which really chimes with your reading material this week, Dol, called The Sex Drought, which I think you would really like. We read a lot about the decline in sex in millennials and some of Gen Z, and it tends to all conform to the idea that, I mean, as you were saying earlier, people, particularly men, watch too much porn and screens are killing real experience. But this piece offered lots of fresh bits of research and coverage. Writer Katie Julian spoke to several experts who suggested that the rates of childhood sexual abuse have decreased in recent decades and that abuse can lead to precocious and promiscuous sexual behaviour. So actually the decline in that has, in some areas, led to a decline in sexual activity. Some people...
Can that be true?
Well, I thought it was quite an interesting point of view. And another point of view that I also thought was interesting, she said that some people today may feel less pressured into sex that they don't want to have, thanks to changing gender mores and growing awareness of diverse sexual orientation. So I think those are two both quite positive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all I ever hear is that basically we don't know how to be intimate and we don't know
But that's all I heard, so I thought it was actually quite interesting to hear a positive take. Less positive, fairly shocking statistics were about what she calls Fertility Challenge Japan, which is something of a case study in the dangers of sexlessness. In 2005, a third of Japanese single people aged 18 to 45 were virgins. By 2005, 43% of people in this age group were virgins. God. And the share who said they did not intend to get married had also risen. Lots of interesting stuff in that piece, actually, and we will link in the show notes. I lastly absolutely adored the Michelle Obama interview in the British edition of Elle by Oprah Winfrey. What a coup for the British glossy. Disclaimer, I am connected with Elle as a contributing editor, but I think that's a feat for anyone, quite frankly.
Agreed.
And I would be flagging that regardless of who it was. The conversation was so revealing and brilliant. It's often not the case with someone immensely famous. Michelle reveals that they sought counselling for their marriage, as Michelle had to learn to exist in a relationship where Barack's mission would often come first. She says what's different about her and the reason why she thinks so many people ask her about her authenticity is that she likes herself. How often do you hear a woman, particularly a woman of colour, feeling empowered enough to say, I like myself? I particularly enjoyed the bits where she describes the difference between her and Barack. She says she is a box checker whilst he is a swerver. And I just wanted to read out a bit. Oprah says, "You write about meeting him. I'd constructed my existence carefully, tucking and folding every loose and disorderly bit of it, as if building some tight and airless piece of origami. He was like a wind that threatened to unsettle everything. You didn't like being unsettled. Oh, God, no. This moment cracks me up," says Oprah. "I woke one night to find him staring at the ceiling, his profile lit by the glow of streetlights outside. He looked vaguely troubled, as if he was pondering something deeply personal. Was it our relationship? The loss of his father? Hey, what are you thinking over there?" I whispered. He turned to look at me, his smile a little sheepish. "Oh," he said, "I was just thinking about income equality." "That's my honey," says Michelle. And I love that. That's my honey. She writes beautifully. Becoming has just landed on my desk this morning and I am so excited to read it. It's being translated into 31 languages in its debut edition.
And on the subject of Michelle Obama, we have a very, very exciting national exclusive, a clip from the audiobook of Becoming. In this extract, she describes one of her first nights alone in their new home after moving out of the White House in 2017. She had the evening to herself, everyone was out, she made cheese on toast and sat outside in the garden with the dogs, obviously still with armed guards less than 100 yards away, giving her the first moment to sit back and not only reflect, but think about what was coming next.
"I was thinking instead about how in a few minutes I would go back inside my house, wash my plate in the sink, and head up to bed, maybe open a window so I could feel the spring air. How glorious that would be. I was thinking, too, that the stillness was affording me a first real opportunity to reflect. As First Lady, I'd get to the end of a busy week and need to be reminded how it had started. But time is beginning to feel different. My girls who arrived at the White House with their Polly Pockets, a blanket named Blanky, and a stuffed tiger named Tiger, are now teenagers, young women with plans and voices of their own. My husband is making his own adjustments to life after the White House, catching his own breath. And here I am, in this new place, with a lot I want to say."
I love that anecdote. In Elle, she explains that she had never been allowed to make herself toast. Someone would always jump up and go do it for her if she made advances towards making a snack. And she said even opening a window that night was really momentous because they were never allowed to open the windows in the White House for security reasons. And when her dogs are outside on the porch with her, she said they'd never heard another dog bark. And that night they did, and it just completely threw them. Just so many tiny, elemental, but awe-inspiring things to consider if you haven't been allowed or haven't witnessed those things. Mm. Opening a window, hearing a dog bark, making a piece of toast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's talk about Mrs. Hinch. Sophie Hinchcliffe, aka at Mrs. Hinch Home on Instagram, has 1.3 million followers despite only starting her account in March of this year, is a cleaning influencer. Cleanfluencer? Cleanstagrammer? I need to work on this. Who posts videos of her cleaning her Essex home. Dolly and I were both baffled and riveted by the Mrs. Hinch phenomenon and decided to probe further in the name of journalism.
I was on her Instagram today and I am fascinated by her commitment to the colour grey.
Yes, serious tonal
absolutely
blocking.
Everything is grey or silver. It's like a dressed set for a sort of suburban space age film.
I watched a few videos and I found the filming quite hectic, although I did enjoy... "You don't need to do your sink every day, Mrs. Hinch," before she then replies to herself, "You kind of do, mate." And then Whitney Houston kicks in with "I Am Every Woman" and she disinfects the sink with something called Star Drops. She then says, "Disinfected it, time to cliff it." And then Respect by Aretha Franklin comes on and she gets out the sieve, which she has named Cliff, the star drops is called Paul.
Oh yeah, she gives all the cleaning products its own their own name.
I'd go there for the music alone, frankly. She's also really glamorous. Occasionally she flashes to her own face, and she's got long lustrous hair extensions, flawless skin, long painted nails, a full set of falsies.
It's kind of a domestic bliss. It's kind of like when I was watching the stories this morning, and it's not just cleaning, it's the dog and the cook making soup. It's kind of like a home.
The Hinchers like it all, don't they?
She calls all her followers the Hinchers. I think that it's like a domesticity porn, kind of.
I wouldn't naturally follow Mrs. Hinch, as I find people doing banal things really boring, but they are hugely popular, these type of like everyday activity videos. Mm. I remember the influencer Naomi Smart used to post videos of her making her dinner, chopping it up, cleaning it, eating it, chopping it up, cooking it, eating it, putting the plates away. And I watched one once and I found it so fascinatingly dull, but people love it. It's like when people post 20 Instagram videos in a row about their day, what they've been up to, what moisturiser they're using. I mean, it's the concept of Big Brother. People adore the banal, it's soothing. And I think I wonder if it's part of ASMR, which stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, a physical sensation of pleasurable tingling, which I learnt about from the Tash Dimitriou episode of Adam Buxton's podcast that you recommended last week, Dull, where she talks about her obsession with slime, which totally baffled Adam, and that watching pictures of people making slime had got her through her recent breakup. I wonder if Mrs. Hinch offers the same kind of catharsis.
Yeah, sort of like hypnosis. It's like a weird, I think it's a couple of things. I think it's voyeurism into the everyday that we've always been obsessed with culturally, but I think we're even more obsessed with now that we live in such a highly glossy, augmented time. I think an insight into the drab feels even more of a rare treat and treasure than an insight into the glamorous. And I also think it's any excuse to be glued to our devices. I've realised that when my social media usage is not at a good point and I'm on my phone too much, I just look for any excuse to stay hooked in, and nothing is more sustainably long-winded and distracting like menial chores and inconsequential blabbering.
Her videos feel very retro, not the aesthetic. Her house, as you say, is all plush silver and shiny chrome, and she wears hoodies, but I mean the sentiment. In a way, it's great that everyone's obsessed, because it means that a woman cleaning her home and feeling validated by it is not something that
it's ironic
women have to do anymore, because women are allowed out of the kitchen to do other things. It's not the 1950s, so Mrs. Hinch cleaning is a choice rather than a demand placed upon her. On the other hand, are we fetishising a tale or a stereotype as old as time that society is desperately trying to move past? A woman cleaning. Wouldn't it be more revolutionary to see Mr. Hinch cleaning?
I'm not so sure. I think some people just like cleaning. That's true. My dad does. Farley does. I think some people get huge enjoyment out of it as an activity, you know, regardless of their gender. Although I have said this before on the High Low, and I've gotten trouble for it, and lots of women email to say it's a constant battle at home with their boyfriends or husbands, because it's an obligation that is by default foisted onto the woman of the house. But maybe it's just because I've never really lived with men, so I don't know. I just have to either clean or hire a cleaner, because I love a clean house, I just don't get much satisfaction from doing it.
I've never had such an overwhelming response to a question I've posed to Twitter than when I asked, can someone talk to me about Mrs. Hinch? Mm. And I received so many replies. Here are some of them. Watching her feels like your house is magically cleaning itself, says Jess. Abigail says she is addicted. Hannah thinks we love it because it generates an illusion of being in control in an increasingly terrifying world.
I think it's that. Mm. I'm convinced that it's that. I think it's about control. And I do think it's symptomatic of a quite dangerous, imperious Western culture of control freakism.
Does it go too far? Jette says, Mrs. Hinch has deep issues about cleanliness and control. Compulsive cleaning can be a part of OCD or OCPD. Incidentally, a new hand washing app has been said to reduce compulsive behaviour by 21%, according to Cambridge University, which is interesting. Sufferers watch a 30-second video of someone washing their hands and it curbs the compulsive behaviour.
That's interesting. I do also think that people too often conflate OCD with an obsession with cleanliness.
Or just a penchant or a like or a love of cleanliness.
And I know two quite severe sufferers of OCD who have absolutely no compulsion at all related to cleanliness or germs. Mm. I think that what we're talking about here is a kind of control fetish that's come from our need to control image, aesthetic, well-being and routine and public image.
I mean, does that mean Mrs. Hinch has deep cleaning issues, or does she just have a Monica Geller type habit that she's enjoying sharing with the world and no doubt making some dosh out of? I mean, she's with Digital Talent Management Gleam, who rep YouTube vloggers like Zoella and Tanya Burr. She's been on This Morning and spoken to publications like The Mirror, sharing her cleaning tips. There's so much scope for product endorsements for her, because I imagine it is not a crowded market. How many influencers want to endorse Sif?
Dear old Kim and Aggie have probably been completely booted out by her. It's such a small talent pool. There won't be space for all of them, I don't think.
I still find it odd calling it Sif. It will forever be
Jif. Me too.
People are going crazy for the chemicals she uses, though. Emily calls it horrifying, while Scarlett finds the chemical shaming bizarre, as do I. I'm sorry, but don't most people use chemicals to clean? I'm not saying we should, and I know there are alternatives, but I do slightly think, let's pick our battles. Scarlett also says there's some underlying reclamation of women's guilt over cleaning not being feminist, but also all women still being the ones who clean.
I'm not going to be shamed about my chemicals. I love a Dettol spray. No one will ever shame me out of that, sadly.
I don't think there's anything wrong with Mrs. Hinch. I think people like her videos because they're therapeutic. It taps into that pleasurable, satisfying feeling, almost like when you see someone on telly doing a really big, genuine smile and you find yourself smiling back at them. Do you ever catch yourself watching it telly alone and you're just going like this? I do it a lot. There are masses of very weird videos out there that make people feel really good, and perhaps cleaning isn't even the weirdest.
There's been yet another diversity issue in entertainment, this time in the very white, very male arena of live comedy. Last week, comedian Lolly Adefope tweeted a poster of a Christmas charity comedy gig organised by Harry Hill, the lineup for which consisted of 24 comedians' faces, all of whom were white. Under the image, she wrote, "Someone's dreaming of a white Christmas." The reaction to the joke was divided. Most of the comedians on the bill publicly supported Lolly, also claiming they had no idea of the all-white lineup. Frankie Boyle said, "Comedy often doesn't do well enough when it comes to representation. When people point instances of this out, we should support them and learn from it." Sarah Pascoe wrote, "I'm sorry if you've had backlash. I don't know how this issue is going to get resolved, but it's so good that you've raised it. Everyone I've spoken to who's involved with the gig is upset this has happened. It's not okay." And Roisin Connaty wrote, "I'm really sorry if people attacked you for pointing this out, Lolly. In 2018, no matter how well-intentioned, a bill like this looks awful. I've spoken to the organisers and said as much. It's not your responsibility to flag this stuff. It's our comedy community as a whole."
Chortle, an online comedy magazine, ran a piece with the headline, "Comedians' Anger Over All-White Comedy Headline." After many people highlighted the inherent racism of defaulting to the angry black woman stereotype, when Lolly's tweet displayed no anger whatsoever, if anything it was hilariously casual, Chortle changed the headline. Lolly herself upholds that she wasn't angry or starting a racism row, quote-unquote, but rather calling out a lack of diversity with a joke. A subsequent statement from her reads, "I think a gig can support a charity and be diverse and have a great lineup. It's called multitasking. And if diversity isn't important to you, then that's fine. That's absolutely your prerogative. But I'm still going to call it out when I see it. Good intentions shouldn't close you off to conversation. I would never want a charity's support to be affected. And so I've donated to Action Duchenne, and anyone who has retweeted or liked my post is obviously welcome to as well. Bye."
The comedian Jason Manford wrote a number of tweets to Lolly defending both himself and the organiser Harry Hill, saying he just said he would do a charity gig and now he's being called a racist. Lolly replied saying, "No one is calling you racist, Jason." He since deleted his tweets, but Lolly has faced a huge amount of accusations of racism herself, accusations that she's taking money from a charity or somehow damaging a charity, and also she's just received a lot of plain and simple abuse, frankly. On the subject of it being for a charity gig, writer Ortega Uwagba tweeted, "I gather Lolly Adefope has received criticism for pointing out the embarrassing lack of diversity on this lineup, given the show is in aid of charity. To be clear, that doesn't exempt its organisers, even a little bit, from criticism." What have you made of this situation, Pandora?
I thought the joke was really funny. It was pitch perfect, short, wry, on the nose. A light joke about something heavy, yeah. Just the way comedy should function. She wasn't calling anyone racist, for God's sake. God, I want to divorce the internet sometimes. I know we wouldn't really have a show without it. I don't know what we taught poetry we've enjoyed from the 30s. God, you'd love that. We should do an internet free high-low one week. Let's do it.
That would be... Oh, God, what a calm week that would be.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. Anyway, back to Lolly.
Back to Lolly. I think the most important thing in this story for me is the nature of the responses to Lolly's tweet rather than the tweet itself. I just feel phenomenally sad for her. It was such a reminder to me of the shit that people of colour have to put up with all the time. Lolly is such a good comedian and commentator. Her humour is so dry and laconic, and she uses it as a really powerful tool to highlight the enormous disparity between the white and black experience. Anyone who knows her work would know that she is known for doing that so effortlessly. And also, anyone in 2018 would have every right to respond to that poster with outrage or irritation or anger, but that's not what she was doing. She was calling out a problem with her own sardonic wit, and I can't imagine how stressful it must be and how censored one must feel as a person of colour to know that even when you just voice a fact that relates to race, you are accused of being angry or starting a race row, and that off the back of those words being put in your mouth, the hurt feelings or bruised egos of men like Jason Manford is suddenly the most important thing in the conversation. As I say, it really reminded me that freedom of expression for a woman of colour just does not exist in the same way that it does for white people.
It's also really curious because speaking about race is, a lot of the time, from what I've seen, like quite a vital component of comedians who are of colour. Like Ramesh Ranganathan like talks extensively about what it is to be of Sri Lankan heritage. I don't know why she's so... I don't really understand why she's suddenly not allowed to make an observation on race that, as you say, like... I mean, it was pretty light. It also just reminds us that people do not know how to take a joke anymore. What the fuck are comedians allowed to make a joke about? I was watching Russell Howard's new show this weekend, actually, and it's very woke. It's... Have you seen any of it?
No.
It's all about politics. It's women's rights, for example. He spent a long time on those. I liked it. I liked that he was spending time making jokes about important shit that doesn't concern him at the expense of... people who have done, you know, shitty things. You could tell that he's really invested and that he really wanted his comedy to move with the times and to have integrity. But I did wonder how much of that was because comedians feel forced into being really PC, that any joke they made is somehow indicative of some, like, dark part of their personality or their prejudice. And you aren't allowed to make jokes that are on the nose. Lolly's joke wasn't even not PC. If anything, it was calling out the failure of the PC-ness.
She's
elsewhere.
She, on the whole, the way she's described it to me, I interviewed her for an article about comedy and wokeness and how they intersect.
Oh, yeah, the piece you wrote for Sunday Times Star.
Yeah, and she, on the whole, is a big fan pretty of woke. Political correctness. Yeah. Yeah, she thinks it's a force for
but
good,
on
the whole.
This is what's funny, is it was, if anything, actually, a PC... Ramesh Ranganathan tweeted saying that he had been invited to join the night but couldn't make the charity gig. Harry Hill also gave a statement saying that other comedians of colour had been asked to join but none could make it. So the intention was not to create an all-white comedy night. But, of course, you don't see the intention unless someone tells you about it. You only see the outcome. You only see the lineup.
I don't think Harry Hill and the organisers should be vilified for this lineup. I think it just highlights a problem that needs to be addressed, which is... not that everyone's racist, but that diversity needs to be more of a pressing issue rather than a tokenistic afterthought.
I think Harry Hill, to be fair to him, has largely accepted that this is, you know, that this is not okay.
Yeah.
That they need to do better another time.
Yeah, yeah, we need to do better. That's exactly what it is, that this needs to be everyone's responsibility. Pandora and I are both on such a learning curve with how we can change this in our personal and work choices. A number of times we've been involved in campaigns or been booked for panel events, and only once the campaign is out or we arrive at the event, we realise it's an all-white or totally heterosexual panel. Both of us have realised, sadly, we can't rely on organisers to ensure diversity. And by doing so, we're abdicating responsibility. And actually, we need to be accountable for that. So now both of us always try to remember to ask who else is on the lineup before we say yes to things. But personally, that hasn't been an inherent impulse for me, which highlights my privilege. I've had to learn that inclusion often doesn't happen without everyone being cognizant of it.
absolutely been a learning curve as we learn about our responsibility, which is that we have to extend our platform that we have here at the Hilo to people who aren't white.
Just for people from all backgrounds.
It's something we take very seriously, not just in terms of guests, but in terms of the topics we cover and the reading recommendations we make. It's something we try and thread throughout the show. But I want to be totally transparent here. When it comes to booking guests, it isn't always easy to make sure we are as diverse as we want to be. In fact, our next author special was one we were probably the most excited about that we have ever been. A huge contemporary name, a woman of colour, but she just cancelled her slot, sadly, which means we now have four white women in a row for our author specials, and we feel really uncomfortable about that.
But the first thing that we did when we got that news, other than feeling very sad, is that we had a conversation where we realised we have to make some decisions to diversify our next guests that we book. And not that's not a box ticking exercise, it's to make our show better.
Yeah, to make our show more interesting, yeah, for ourselves and for our listeners, rather than hearing from people from very similar viewpoints all the time. The show's always been about educating ourselves as much as others, and it's a really necessary part of the privilege of having a show like The Hilo, which is, you know, doing pretty well and reaching lots of ears. And so it's one we take really seriously. It makes us uncomfortable that we have four white women in a row. And I think this makes a point in itself that it is a chicken and an egg situation. We like authors of a certain caliber on the show, but there aren't enough women of colour being published and published to high acclaim, which means there are less being suggested or pitched as a slot on the Hilo. Probably only 5% of authors offered to us aren't white, would you say? Which means less girls are being inspired, and so the circle continues.
Yeah, and it is often more thought or time consuming to create a lineup of people, not just talking about race, but a lineup that is fully diverse in terms of age, background, gender, sexuality. But that's only because the default for so long has been to not think about it, which is not only deeply wrong, but as I say, it also just makes for very boring one note conversation and comedy and art. The point that Lolly is trying to make, I think, is that either it's one of your priorities or it isn't. It's too easy to say, oh, well, that author cancelled or that comedian isn't free, so it's just going to be an all-white lineup, but who cares, at least we tried. When I interviewed Lolly about comedy and wokeness, she said that that attitude of cursory box-ticking for her doesn't make any real change or difference, that people have to truly care about diversity for it to be followed through in their choices.
I don't know if I agree with that argument, because what if an organiser is just box-ticking but books someone really awesome who then makes it big and can go on to inspire tons of other people? I don't think the intention, as I said earlier, always matters, whether they're booked with good or thoughtless or cursory intention. If someone talented is given the platform, then they are able to occupy and claim rightful ownership and go on and inspire others. I'm not saying that I can't see how it would be considered offensive if you know you are being booked to tick a box, but I don't think that it always fails to affect real change.
Underneath her statement on Instagram, Lolly commented, "I'd also love it if people would call this stuff out themselves if they care about it. Don't just send me the photo knowing that I'll speak up about it and face the backlash. Highlight it yourselves and have the conversation so I don't get accused of playing the race card, or if you don't care about it at all, have a nice day." It was a really needed reminder, I think, to me, that we shouldn't leave all this legwork for change to people of colour, particularly when they're the ones who receive so much more abuse for it. So while I'm sad that the response to Lolly's tweet was so disappointing, I'm grateful for its reminder that diversity is a collective responsibility.
Absolutely. And ultimately, the support of other comedians and the discussion of this topic by so many people and media outlets will ensure that this happens less and less in the future. Thank you very much to everyone who listened to The Hilo. You can email us, thehiloshow@gmail.com, or tweet us at The Hilo Show. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps boost us in the charts and helps other people find us. Bye-bye.
Wrap up warm.
Bye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.